From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Thursday, January 19th, 2017. And on this day, we'll look at why Senator Angus King says he'll vote against Scott Pruitt to head the Environmental Protection Agency. And the LePage administration wants a $7 million bailout of the Maine Military Authority. That's ahead in a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Masters of Policy Planning and Management, preparing students to be a force for positive change in their communities.
Independent Maine Senator Angus King says he will vote against President-elect Donald Trump's nomination of Scott Pruitt to head the Environmental Protection Agency. King said he sat through Pruitt's confirmation hearings yesterday as an audience member, did some additional research, and came to the conclusion that the Oklahoma Attorney General is not appropriate for the job. Susan Sharon has more.
Pruitt's nomination to head the EPA has been controversial from the start. He's filed suit against the agency 14 times, has opposed the Clean Power Plan, disputed the Clean Air Act's authority, and opposed rules that require coal-fired plants to cut their mercury emissions by 90%. King says there's no record that he can find of Pruitt being, quote, affirmative and strong in enforcing environmental laws as Attorney General.
My fundamental problem with him is that he just doesn't believe in the mission of the Environmental Protection Agency.
During his Senate confirmation hearing Wednesday, Pruitt was grilled over a series of letters he sent to federal agencies on state stationery that were critical of the economic effects of environmental rules and drafted, almost word for word, by energy lobbyists. King says that bothers him.
This morning I went back and read one of those letters that was drafted entirely by an energy company. Out of 1,000 words, I think he changed 37, and most of them were pretty inconsequential.
In his testimony before the Environment and Public Works Committee, Pruitt backed away slightly from previous statements he's made about the human role in climate change. He told the committee that scientists tell us the climate is changing and human activity in some manner impacts that change. But King calls that a lukewarm statement and says many of President-elect Trump's nominees are using similar language that sounds like a scripted response. For all of these reasons, King says he'll vote against Pruitt's nomination.
I just can't, in good conscience, as somebody who's taken seriously environmental protection all my life, approve the appointment of someone who is so manifestly opposed, as I say, to the mission of the agency.
Environmental groups are now calling on Republican Maine Senator Susan Collins to follow King's lead in rejecting Pruitt for the EPA post. For inspiration, Pete Dittesheim of the Natural Resources Council of Maine says Collins and others can look at what happened to Anne Gorsuch Burford, President Reagan's choice to run the agency in the early 1980s.
She was patently unqualified for the position, pursued an agenda that was aimed directly, like Scott Pruitt's, at eviscerating the agency, and there was such a national outpouring of rage and opposition that she left her post in 1983.
Burford was actually forced to resign after she refused to turn over Superfund records and was cited for contempt by Congress. In Maine, Dittesheim says environmental protection has always been a bipartisan issue, and that's why Bill Mook of Mook Sea Farm in Walpole says he'll hold Collins accountable if she supports Pruitt. Mook says he's voted for Collins many times in the past.
If she supports this nomination, I would not only not vote for her again, I would actively campaign against her.
Senator Collins could not be reached for comment, but her spokesperson Annie Clark said Collins met with Pruitt earlier this month and will begin to review his confirmation testimony over the weekend. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
The LePage administration is proposing a $7 million bailout of the Maine Military Authority. The proposal would help the authority satisfy the terms of a $19 million contract with the Massachusetts Bay Transit Authority to refurbish nearly two dozen commuter buses. As Steve Missler reports, the administration says the taxpayer bailout will help the MMA complete the contract, but its future beyond that remains unclear.
The MMA bailout is an item in the governor's supplemental budget package, which includes additional funding requests for the fiscal year that ends in June. State officials say most of the $7 million goes to losses associated with the Massachusetts Bay Transit Authority contract. The bailout would allow the MMA to rehire workers, complete the contract work, and create a special reserve fund. In September, Governor Paul LePage announced that he was halting the bus refurbishment work, saying the contract was underbid and MMA was losing money. By October, the MMA had laid off 35 of its 65 workers. But questions remained about the future of the contract, about half of which was incomplete. On Wednesday, Department of Defense Veterans and Emergency Management Commissioner Doug Farnham told the legislature's Budget Writing Committee that the state has been in talks with the Massachusetts Bay Transit Authority, or MBTA.
Our goal has been to renegotiate with MBTA to limit the downside of the current contract while positioning the talented workforce and top-notch facility for future economic opportunities.
Farnham says those talks are still ongoing. He also said the MMA has partnered with a private company to reduce risk in future contracts, although it's not clear if the unnamed company will receive a slice of the proposed bailout. What is clear is that MMA needs to settle its debts. Farnham said the MBTA contract was signed amid pressure to save the MMA, which once employed over 500 people. He described a desperate MMA outmaneuvered by the more sophisticated negotiators in Massachusetts.
They had what they thought was a good deal. They get in there, they get in a more competitive bidding process. Again, not like doing a government contract, and they were talked down to be competitive. They wanted the business, and they were talked down at a couple different levels.
The MMA is located at the former Loring Air Force Base in Limestone. It was once nationally known for its ability to retrofit and repair Humvee vehicles for the National Guard, and it has refurbished more than 16,000 vehicles and generated $600 million in revenue, according to the MMA. But when the Humvee business dried up, the agency looked for other contracts to keep its remaining workers employed. It landed a deal with the MBTA to refurbish specialized buses. But MMA apparently did not anticipate costs to repair buses made by a German company that went out of business before the deal was signed. With no company to furnish the replacement parts, costs for the bus repairs increased. In some instances, Farnham said, the agency was fabricating new parts. Hugh Corbett is the MMA's executive director. In a separate hearing before the Veterans and Legal Affairs Committee, Corbett made his case for the bailout to lawmakers. He reminded them that the MMA helped fill budget gaps during its heyday.
But it's important to understand that when Maine Military Authority does well, it does well by the state also.
Farnham said he hopes the MMA will continue after the contract is completed. But Republican Representative Jeff Timberlake told Farnham that it might be time to privatize MMA.
I don't want to see us dumping in another $7 million. You know, when private sector is involved, it's coming out of somebody else's pocket, not mine.
Farnham didn't disagree, but he said the focus right now is to get out from under the MBTA contract.
We were in a situation where we had to halt. We were losing money like crazy, but at the same time, we signed a contract.
The Budget Writing Committee will continue to review the proposal before it goes to the legislature for votes. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
700 people who work in the real estate business here in Maine are in Portland today for the annual conference of the Maine Real Estate and Development Association. The association compiles an index of economic activity that goes by its acronym MERIDA. Erwin Gratz talked with the group's president earlier today in our Portland studios.
It looks like it's generally been a pretty good year for the real estate industry, although I did notice that the MERIDA index dropped slightly in the last reporting quarter. Any idea why that's going on?
Yeah, the real estate market in Maine is very strong right now, but it did dip slightly this last quarter due to construction employment. There aren't enough construction workers out there, and they continue to retire. So we're not getting new employees replacing the older retiring employees, and that is going to be a continuing problem.
Is there a particular sector of the real estate business that did better than others during the past year?
I think the residential sector has been very strong in the last 2 years, both in the multifamilies and in the single families, and that's been driving. That's about 50% component of our MERIDA index. But we've also seen a lot of growth in the hospitality sector. We've seen growth in the commercial sector. There's been some new construction in industrial space, retail space.
It's interesting that you mentioned the retail space. I was kind of wondering in particular how that sector has done. We of course, hear a lot of stories from the just completed holiday shopping season about how much more shopping is being done online.
Demand for retail space is still strong. The more urban areas are still growing. I mean, we were just driving through Portland, And West Elm, which is a national retailer, is going into the old White Cap restaurant on Middle Street. This is a national retailer, Class A. You hadn't seen that in Portland before Urban Outfitters moved in. So we're seeing the Portland have the national scale. But you're also seeing retail growth in Bangor. The Bangor Mall has done very, very well with the shoppers from Canada. The exchange rate had been favorable. It's a little less favorable now. But you're seeing retail in Bangor grow. Downtown Bangor is growing. There's retail growing there, surrounding restaurants, surrounding new apartments. It's interesting to see the growth of Bangor, which is mirroring the growth of Portland. The last couple of years, construction costs have increased up to 20%, and a lot of that's attributed to labor costs, and the labor costs are attributed to the fact that there aren't enough workers. We want to see more of our Maine citizens and our children stay in the state, and construction jobs are great jobs. They pay well. They're not minimum wage jobs. These are skilled workers. Plumbers, electricians, sheetrockers, carpenters.
And does the state need to pay any more attention to things like its community colleges or other kinds of schooling for these kinds of careers?
Well, that's a great point. And we have the president of the Maine Community College System speaking at our forecast conference today. I think Governor LePage has talked a lot about that also. He's talked about, can our high schools do more to train our children? Can there be a high school-college connection where maybe high school goes a little longer and trains our children? So he's got some good ideas, and I think that they need to be listened to.
All right. A couple of questions about the things going forward. The Federal Reserve Board has signaled that it plans to perhaps raise interest rates 3 times in the year ahead. Is that likely to dampen real estate activity in the state?
Interest rates are an important factor in penciling out a real estate deal. So developers sit down, they look at construction costs, land costs, income, and cost of borrowing funds. So yes, a rise in interest rate will have an impact on commercial real estate and new construction. Now, what the impact is will vary according to what the project is. So good projects will always be good projects. Projects in good locations that there's a need. Higher interest rates might pencil out some lesser projects, some projects that may not be the best projects to build.
And, of course, we have a change of administration in Washington. Is there any way to gauge how that's going to affect construction or real estate activity here in the state?
I think the commercial real estate industry and the development industry is excited to some degree with President Trump's ambitious goals of infrastructure growth. We know that our bridges, our roads, our airports, our ports need tremendous amount of capital investment. And President Trump has expressed interest in promoting infrastructure development and spending. So I think that the industry is excited about that.
That's Paul Peck, president of the Maine Real Estate and Development Association, which is holding its annual conference in Portland today. Only about 60% of Maine public school students are considered proficient in science. Elementary school students devote less than 2 hours a week to the subject, and barely half of middle schools have lab stations or supplies. But as Robbie Feinberg reports, a new effort from some Maine schools is looking to help students by actually eliminating standalone science and social studies classrooms.
For the most part, the basic school schedule hasn't changed much from 10 or even 20 years ago. Students still go from, say, math class in one period to English class in another, then to science, social studies, and on and on. But not at Richmond Middle School, south of Augusta. Here, students devote every morning to only 2 subjects, literacy and math. There are workshops, computer programs, lots of activities to build up their skills. And in the afternoon, rather than focusing on science or social studies, the kids take part in college-style seminar classes on one specific subject.
So it won't take much.
In this seminar, 8th graders Andrew Vachon and Elijah Bezenson are crafting a skit about what makes a good leader.
We're doing a skit, and we're going to, like brag to each other, like we were actually meeting each other about what we did well, and then like critique the other person on what they didn't do well, so we can hit that in like a fun way.
But this is part of a much larger unit. Over the past 6 weeks, the students have spent every day in this seminar class talking about leadership. They've traveled to leadership classes and used games to teach younger students how to be leaders. Everything is designed around that one idea.
You know, our brains are built as inquisitive tools. And so if they're the ones that have control over asking the question and finding the answer, it just creates, I picture it like a vortex, and it just kind of sucks up information.
Bill Zima is the superintendent of RSU2, which includes Richmond. He says these seminars were designed as a way to get students to see that math and social studies and science shouldn't be siloed off from one another. They have to connect.
We just feel that you can't teach it in isolation. Kids have to be embedded in something. We call it productive struggle.
So starting this year, teachers put together about 8 or 9 of these seminars every 6 weeks. Students choose which ones they want based on the subjects they still need to learn, which is different for every student. Then teachers are responsible for designing the courses. Teacher Kit Canning says that can be hard as the subjects vary wildly. Kids learn about space travel, 3D printing, or building the school website. That's a subject on which Canning himself had almost no experience. But he says it didn't hold him or the kids back.
I didn't know all that much about it. I knew the basics, but we all learned how to do it together. And next one they want me to do is sign language.
Do you know sign language?
No.
No?
So another one we'll be learning together.
It sounds great. I just hope that it doesn't mean that the kids are getting less exposure to it.
Diana Allen, the president-elect of the Maine Science Teachers Association, is encouraged by efforts in some districts to integrate subjects as a way to engage students. But she's also concerned that it comes as more and more schools are cutting science and social studies classes.
Some school districts are trying to add more time for reading and language arts and math, and so they're cutting back, going from every other day science and social studies in the schedule.
The numbers bear this out. Over the past 2 decades, the number of hours that Maine elementary school students spend on science has continually fallen to less than 2 hours a week. Educators say less emphasis is put on social studies, too, because it's not covered on standardized tests.
So how are you going to present this information?
Some of the students in Richmond say they've struggled with this as well. While many say they like creating big projects around one topic, 8th grader Paige LaBelle says she feels like she's missing out on traditional subjects.
This takes away science and social studies, and also it makes it so now we only get gym, music, art, and foreign language and stuff once a week.
Other students, including Elijah Bezenson, say the integrated courses have made some subjects easier. Like when he applied what he learned in English class to a seminar on building a website.
Yeah, like I was able to take some ELA stuff that I would normally have to do on my own and able to put it into something that was more fun for me.
Diana Allen with the Maine Science Teachers Association acknowledges that finding that connection in a subject like science or social studies can be just as important as setting aside time for the subject in a school schedule.
Kids don't always know what's best for them, but if they're liking the teacher, if they're engaged with the teacher, then they're probably paying attention to what's happening in class more.
A few other districts have approached this on a school-wide level as well, including the Cornville Regional Charter School near Skowhegan. Ultimately, the first measure of success in these districts will be student engagement. And RSU2 Superintendent Bill Zima says that if that improves, he expects that grades and test scores will follow. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
And that's This Day in Maine, Thursday, January 19th, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.